You're listening to a podcast by Pastor Fred Thompson at Mount Gilead Baptist Church.
I heard a little interesting story one time, and back in those days when I used to fly more than I do now, but I used to enjoy whenever I took an airline flight of always requesting the window seat. Now, the reason I liked the window seat was two reasons. I always like to see where I'm going into and out of. But when I'm leaving my home and wherever it was that I lived at, I always would try to look out the window and hope that the way the airplane went, I could catch a glimpse of my house. Did any of you ever travel and try to do that? Try to pick out if you get a chance to fly? Okay. I heard a little story about an airline that as they were getting ready to leave and they were taking off, and the guy was sitting in the window seat there, and as the plane's climbing out, he looked at his seatmate sitting next to him, and he said, you see that lake right down there? He said, I grew up fishing on that lake. He said, when I was a little boy, I'd be out there on that lake fishing, and I'd hear a plane going over, and I'd think, boy, I wish I was up there in that airplane. He said, now, I'm up here in this airplane, and I wish I was down there on that lake fishing. We're always, wherever we're at, something else always seems to be more fulfilling. Well, that's actually the lesson we're going to look at today. We're still in Ecclesiastes, so turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We're doing the series Chasing Answers to Life's Questions, and the question today is, why is my life unfulfilling? Now, the subtitle of this lesson would be this: I hate my life. And in fact, I almost put that up there as the title, and then I thought that's probably a little strong because I'm not sure everyone would say, I hate my life. Some of you might be able to say that this morning, but not everybody. But you're going to find out in a second that that's exactly where Solomon was in his life. So I thought, well, something in the title that would catch everybody would simply be this: why is my life unfulfilling? If he hated his life, that's why he hated his life. It just was an unfulfilling life. So this is sort of a continuation of last week. Last week we looked at the first 11 verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 2, and so we're going to sort of do a little quick review of those, because one of the reasons that my life is unfulfilling is this: I'm seeking the meaning for life through self-gratification. In other words, I'm trying to find meaning and doing things that just, they gratify me. Now, if you remember last week when we looked at that in verses 1 through 3, we looked at the fact that he sought for gratification through pleasure, just doing stuff that's fun. As a matter of fact, when we got near the end, around verse 10 or 11 there, and he just said, there was nothing that my eyes withheld that I held back from. I sought pleasure, but pleasure was emptiness. It didn't bring me any fulfillment or any meaning to life. He sought through possessions. He said, you know what? I built houses. I don't know if you remember from last week, but it took him 7 years to build the temple, but 14 years to build his own palace. And he built buildings, he built gardens, he built forests. He just did everything toward gathering things for himself, possessions. In the end, he said, it's all vanity. It's all meaningless. It's just a vapor. It's a whoosh, and it's gone. Then he talked about the fact that he tried to gain meaning in life through entertainment. I mean, you know, here's the guy that he didn't turn on his MP3 player to listen to something or turn on the radio. No, whoever was the entertainer, he had them come in. They were live entertainment in his house every week or in his palace. But he just said, you know what? That too was just vanity. He tried it through sensuality. You remember? 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's 1,000 women at his disposal. And yet he said, hey, just meaningless. It's a breath. It's a vapor. It's gone. Fame. He said, I'm the greatest that there is. You know, he said, I got more wisdom. I got more power. I got more riches. I got more everything you can think of. And you know what I'm finding? It's all meaningless. It's just a vapor. It brings no meaning to life. And then the last thing that we looked at was this: through restrained pleasure seeking. Now that maybe seemed odd to say through restrained pleasure seeking. What he was basically saying is this: I was pursuing this self-gratification in my life, but I never lost my head. I kept my mind about me. I kept my wisdom. I never just plunged in and took off without trying to keep in mind some of the consequences of what I was doing. And in fact, that sort of brings us to this part of chapter 2, verse 12, is that somebody might have walked up to Solomon at that point and said, well, this is the reason you didn't enjoy self-gratification. This is the reason you didn't enjoy pleasure. You just didn't turn loose and go for it. It was restrained. You tried to keep your wisdom. You tried to make sure you were paying attention to the consequences. And Solomon begins to answer that question. And so as we begin in verse 12, let's just take a look and go ahead and read verse 12. Verse 12 says this, "So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done." He says, I'm going to start considering this. Is it better just to plunge in with your eyes closed and seek pleasure? Or is wisdom still the way to go? And one of the first things he considered was this. You know what? I'm the king. And I've reached the top. But you know what? I've nowhere to go. Have you ever heard that? Once you reach the top, the only way is down. You're there. You're there at the top. One of the best examples I can ever think of from history of someone who had achieved the top was Alexander the Great. Any of you ever heard of Alexander the Great? He was the one who conquered all the known world in about 300 BC in that time frame. Alexander the Great, by the time he was 16, was the ruler of Macedonia. Now, his father Philip was the king. And so he became the ruler at age 16. By the history books, by the age of 18, he was a victorious general. Can you imagine an 18-year-old general? I don't know about you, but if you watch the news, when the Pentagon appears and the generals come and speak on television, there are no 18-year-olds out there talking. They've been around for a while before they become a general. By the time he was 20, he was a king. He had established himself as the kingship. By the age of 30, he had conquered the known world of that time. And he was on his way to invade India, but his troops and his soldiers basically said, "You got to let us go home." He was undefeated. He was never defeated in any battle. And so Alexander the Great goes down as one of the greatest commanders of all history in all the world. At the age of 30, can you imagine that? Conquering the known world of that time, the civilized world. But at the age of 30, after conquering the world, he went to his tent. He wept and cried and said, "There are no more new worlds to conquer." And at that age, he turned to alcohol. And he began to drink heavily. Now, there's some suspicion about his death. Some suspect that maybe he was poisoned. Some suspect that other things may have happened. But 3 days before his death, he went on a major drinking binge. And they described this huge cup that he would fill full of alcoholic beverages and just guzzle them down. Alexander the Great, dead at 33. The man who conquered the world had everything. He reached the top, and there was nowhere to go for him but down. What Solomon was saying here is this: I've reached the top, and now from this point on, everything's just repetitious. I've done it. In fact, he even says, no one else can even show me anything new. He goes, if you try to do the same thing I've done, guess what? I've already done it. You're not going to make it. You're not going to be able to show me anything new. I know in today's world, and we talked about this a little bit last week, you might say, well, yeah, there are new things in the world. There are things that I'm sure he's never seen. Well, that may be too true, but you know what? It was just a different toy. You show him something new, but it's really just a different toy. It has the same effect, has the same thing that he's already tried, maybe just a different toy along the way. Here he is. He's reached the top, and he says, I've nowhere to go. Reaching the top brings me no meaning to life. I'm just unfulfilled at where I'm at. Then look with me at verses 13 through 15, and he begins to explore a little bit more that concept of wisdom versus foolishness. He says, then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. It's also meaningless. He says this, I've realized that even my wise planning doesn't last forever. Even wise planning and trying to make sure everything falls into place brought no fulfillment in my life. But he said, I did pay attention to this. You may come to me and tell me the reason that self-gratification didn't work in my life was that I didn't just cast aside all restraints and jump in and try to find pleasure without trying to have any restraints or considering the consequences. But he said, I've realized this. It's a whole lot smarter to walk in the dark with your eyes open in a flashlight than it is in the dark with your eyes closed. The other night, Julia was going through the house and she had put something over her face, and she's going, Daddy, am I getting close to the steps? And I said, honey, the best thing for you to do is pull that off your head so you can see where the steps are at. You know, the reason for that is this. When your eyes are closed and you're not paying attention to the consequences, you run into something. There's something that catches you by surprise. And he says this, wisdom's still the best choice. It's better to keep your head. Because why? Foolishness will certainly lead to ruin. Foolishness will certainly lead to ruin. I don't know if you ever watch any of these shows on TV, and I don't watch them that often, but every now and then there's nothing else to see. And it was one of these shows that was, I don't remember the title of it now, but it was Stupid Things That People Do. And it was video clips where they've videoed somebody that's trying to jump a bicycle over something, and of course, you know, the results are disastrous. The one that stands out in my mind as the most were three guys who came out, and they're standing on the side, and about where the keyboard is at is a cactus patch. And one of the guys looks at the cactus patch, takes a run and go, and does a flip and lands in it on his back. It didn't take me even for a second to realize that wasn't a real smart choice. And, of course, his friends have to pull him out, and when they pull him out, you can imagine what his back looked like. If you've ever been around a cactus at all, the cactus were pretty prominent in Florida, and I remember when Grace was just an infant. She was real small walking, and she walked over to a cactus. When it rains, sometimes they will bloom, and it had a beautiful yellow bloom on it, and before I could stop her, she reached down to touch the bloom. And I got her hand, but she'd already touched it, and I pulled it back, and in her finger were just like 25 or 30 little hair-like stickers in her finger. And there in the sunlight, I had to take a pair of tweezers and one by one pull those out. Fortunately, it didn't start hurting her for a few minutes. But I'm thinking, this guy, what were you thinking? As a matter of fact, you know what? They interviewed him, and they said, what were you thinking? And he said, seemed like a whole lot better idea when I first did it. I don't know if they had to take him to the hospital or not, but I can imagine that it was not a very pleasant experience either way. Well, that's sort of a foolish consequence when I'm telling you that side of the story, but living your life without wisdom and without foolishness can even be even more serious. Some of you grew up in the time frame that you'll remember this name. Her name was Janis Joplin. How many of you remember that name? She has some of the top songs of all history, or were recorded by her. Janis Joplin died at 27. She made a statement in her early life that her goal in life was to experience everything by the age of 30. And if you know anything about her life, she absolutely took no consideration into what she did. She did drugs, she did sex, she did whatever there was out there, she did it. And at the age of 27, it killed her. And that's what Solomon is saying. You're telling me to cast off all restraint? Oh, no. It's still better to go into things with your eyes open than it is to go in with it foolish. Then in verses 16 through 17, he ran into another thing as he began to consider that. And he's already sort of introduced it there in verse 14 and 15. But in 16 and 17, he says this, for of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. And here it comes, So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind. Here's what he came to the realization. I won't live forever. He looks at everything, and he's examined everything, and he's gone through self-examination, and he says this: I've realized that no matter what I do in life, I'm going to die. As a matter of fact, whether you're foolish or you're wise, you're going to die. Death is a certainty for everyone. It's been said that death levels the playing field, that death is the great equalizer. No one escapes it. Now, in the New Testament, we're told that. Hebrews 9:27 just tells us this. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that, the judgment. We're going to die. It's inevitable. I know that's a sobering thought this morning. But that's where Solomon came to in his life when he began to look at everything. He said, you know what? It doesn't matter what we do in life. One day, it comes to an end. I served as a chaplain for a period of time in a hospital. It was a part-time thing, a scholarship thing, while I was in seminary. And here's what I discovered. Young, middle-aged, old, healthy, wealthy, and wise. They're all forms in the hospital. And out of all those forms in the hospital, some of all of those died. I visited with families who were young who died. I visited with families who were old who died. They all died. It didn't make any difference what their wealth was or how wise they were or how smart they were. Sometimes we find ourselves yearning to be like some of the people who are wealthy and famous. And yet, you know what? Death still comes. It doesn't stop. Elvis Presley, the king, he had everything you can imagine. He had money. He had fortune and fame. And yet, by the standards of most people, he died very young. Michael Jackson, one of the more recent ones. Here was a guy who had just everything you could think of. And yet, what happened? He died young. Now, we may remember some of those like Elvis and some of those like Michael Jackson and maybe others that have passed away. But here's the other thing that Solomon came to the conclusion is this. After death, we'll soon be forgotten. After death, we'll soon be forgotten. He said, there's going to come a time when there's no remembrance. Here's the truth. I can tell you back to my grandparents and my great-grandparents, a couple of them. But I cannot tell you anything about my great-great-grandparents. Why? Because as the generations come and the generations go, they're forgotten. Sobering thing is to, and I've mentioned this before, is to walk through our cemetery. And you'll find graves with no marker. You'll find graves that you know someone is buried there, but there's no record of who that person is. Forgotten. Solomon says, you know what? All the wisdom and everything else I've done and all the wealth and all the power, I've realized I'm going to die. Yeah, I can't escape it. And I hate life. I'm so discouraged with life because there's just no meaning in the things that I've done. He also began to realize in verses 18 through 23 this, I've realized I can't take it with me. I'm going to leave it all behind. Not only am I going to die, everything I've got, I'm going to leave behind. Look at verses 18 and follow with me as I read through 23. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil over it or for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. I read a little story about four guys, and I'm sure it's a joke because I can't imagine it actually taking place, but there are four guys. They were really, really good friends. They played golf together. They did everything together. And one day, one of the men called all of them together, and he says, "You know, I know that someday I'm going to die, and I've amassed this great fortune. So here's what I want you to do. I'm going to give each of you this large sum of money. But now what I want you to do is when I die, when you walk past my casket, I want you to put that money in the casket with me. Because I believe I can figure out a way to take it with me." So, sure enough, the day came and the man died. They were all there at the memorial service and the casket was open. And as the men filed by, they looked in and they said, "Well, it was a great guy. He was a great guy. It was good, all the things we did with him." And so then the time came and they went out to the cemetery. And, of course, the casket was lowered down into the ground. And they're all still standing around the graveside and they began to talk about him, and they said, "You know, I sure do hope that he can take that stuff with him." One guy says, "Yes, you know, I felt pretty bad about dropping that $30,000 into his casket." And the other one said, "Well, you know, I sort of hated dropping that $30,000 in there too." He said, "I just don't know, you know, whether he's going to be able to take it with him or not." And the other guy was pretty silent, and so finally they looked over and he says, "Well, what about you? What about the $30,000?" He said, "I just hope they have a bank in heaven with that check I dropped in." He was smart enough to know you can't take it with you. It's been said a lot of times, there are no U-Hauls behind a hearse. You know, you can't take it with you. He says this, "What I've gained through hard work will be enjoyed by someone else. I've worked my fingers to the bone. I've gained everything. And then after me, someone else is going to get it." Last week, you know, we looked at, and you talked about Bill Gates and his home. An acre and a half home in square foot. That's a huge, I can't even imagine that. But who gets it after Bill Gates is gone? When he's amassed all of those things, who gets that? Solomon goes on to say, "I can't control what those who get my stuff will do with my prized possessions. Some fool may get what I've worked so hard for, and they're going to destroy it as soon as they get it." How would you stop and think in history? And I honestly couldn't think of a name, but I can think of instances along the way. But of people who died wealthy, and what do their kids do? They squander the wealth. And they live in poverty because they squandered the wealth of their wealthy parents. You know, Solomon, actually this happened to him. When Solomon died, Solomon had been sort of a taskmaster in some ways of having people work and build all these things for him. And so when Solomon finally died and his son Rehoboam was coming to be king, the people came to him and said, "Rehoboam, you need to back off just a little bit. Give the people some rest. So Solomon has really been sort of rough on us, and we need to back off." Well, Rehoboam consulted some of the older advisors who had been around with his father Solomon, and they said, "You need to listen to the people." But Rehoboam turned to some of the young whippersnappers that were his sidekicks, and they said, "No, Rehoboam, what you need to do is you need to tell them, if you thought my father's hand was heavy, my thumb's going to even be heavier." And you know what happened? He listened to the advice of his peers, and the kingdom was torn apart. Solomon was the only king of Israel that had total peace during his entire reign. And yet, at the end of his reign, with all his wealth and his fortune and his fame, it was torn apart by a son who made a foolish decision. He even goes on to say, "I've lost sleep to achieve, and someone else enjoys the reward." Solomon said, "There's been nights that I've laid on my bed, tossing and turning, thinking about the things I'm trying to achieve, the things I'm trying to accomplish." Here's the bottom line. Between the one when he realized that I'm going to die and he realized I can't take it with me, the bottom line is this. All your hard work, your education, which people say they can never be taken away from you, any wealth, any power, any fame, when you die, it's all left behind. And in Solomon's wisdom, he said, it's just vanity. It's meaningless. It's a vapor. But then in verses 24 through 26, he comes to the first of several conclusions in the book of Ecclesiastes. And the first conclusion he comes to is this: to enjoy life, I need to answer the question, what pleases God? Verses 24 through 26 say this: there is nothing better for a person that he should eat, drink, and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. He comes to the conclusion, you know what? The only thing that really matters is whether I'm pleasing God. He looks at the lesson there and he looks at it and he sees that, well, first let me make this comment. As I understand it, in verse 24, in the translations, they add a word in there that really isn't in the original Hebrew language. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. The word better is not in there. That really the way it reads is this: there is nothing for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment. In other words, there is nothing that I do in my life that I myself can find enjoyment in. It's only from the hand of God that I will find enjoyment. It's only through pleasing God and doing what God wants us to do that we can find meaning in life and we can enjoy life. You know, every generation answers that question, what pleases God, a little bit differently. We all look at it differently. And, you know, even in your life, you probably have recognized that even in your own life, as you've grown, there's been different ways you would answer that question. There's been those who have said, you know what pleases God is the way we dress and the way we act. All outward appearance. That's what's important, that we look like we're Christians and we walk like Christians and we talk like Christians. Well, that's true. I think God wants us to be that. But is that what truly pleases God? When you do that, it sometimes it can be just an outward act that you're putting on. Well, there's other generations that have come along and said, no, it's being about helping people. I mean, James even said that true religion is helping the orphans and the widows. So it must be about helping people then, that's how we please God. But even that can be done by people that have no desire to please God. They just want to try to gain brownie points. Not because they're pleasing him, but because they think that they'll earn some reward for having done that. Here's the bottom line. Hebrews tells us this: without faith, it is impossible to please God. And the key is that God says the way you please me is through faith. It's not by the outward things, the way you look. It's not by the things you do, even though those things are important. What makes the difference is what is in here. The faith that you have and the trust that's in me. Solomon says that God gives us life and work to enjoy. Now some of us think, I can't believe that work is supposed to be for us to enjoy. He really did give us work for us to enjoy. He gave those things to us because he wants us to enjoy them. He also says that God blesses those who seek him first. It talks in there that God has given wisdom and knowledge and things like that to those who seek him first. And he tells us that those who don't seek God first will eventually lose everything. As a matter of fact, the way Solomon words it is, those who have done things foolishly and they're not trying to please God, everything they've gained will actually end up being enjoyed by those who have pleased God, but those who have followed him. The majority of people believe that circumstances and people exist to make them happy. Don't you find that to be a little bit true? As a matter of fact, we have to be careful that we don't think the same thing. But God, Jesus said, where our treasure is where our heart is. And if our heart is in a desire to please God and having faith in God, guess where our treasure will be? It'll be there also. In Luke chapter 12, verses 13 through 21, Jesus sort of talked about this a little bit in the parable that, at least on my Bible, and your Bible may be titled differently, is this, the parable of the rich fool. In this one it says, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And then he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, 'What shall I do, for I have nowhere to store my crops?' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." In that parable, Jesus is talking about a rich man who had amassed a great fortune, and so much of a fortune he didn't know what to do with it. And so what he decided to do was just build storehouses so that he could save his fortune and then sit back and relax, eat, drink, and be merry. But Jesus said that God said, "Fool, today your life will be required of you." Now listen, there was nothing wrong with his wealth. There was nothing wrong with him accumulating all the riches and everything else. What was missing? What was missing is this. He decided to use it on himself without any thought of whether he was pleasing God or not. God wasn't even in his equation. There was no thought about what God wanted him to do with the riches that he had accumulated. There was no thought about pleasing him. When we come to a place in our life and we're looking for fulfillment in our life and we're trying to find, what is it, God, in which I find fulfillment? What Solomon is telling us here is his first conclusion is this. You're going to find fulfillment in your life when you reach the place of trying to answer the question, what pleases God? And then you seek to please God.
Thank you for tuning in. If you're ever in the Griffin area, we would love to have you come visit us at 10:45 on Sunday mornings. Our location is 14550 Highway 19 South in Griffin, Georgia. I hope you have a wonderful day. And remember, God loves you.